We hope you enjoy the following presentation of Astrology and Transpersonal Living, Part 1, by Dane Rudjar, with an introduction by Leila Royale. This was the opening presentation of the RITA Conference on September 23, 1983, in Palo Alto, California. This recording is 46 minutes long. This audio is brought to you by RITA, the Rudjar Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudjar. All material is copyrighted by Leila Rudjar Hill. If you'd like to learn more about RITA or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudjar, visit www.rudjarinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudjar, visit www.rudjaraudioarchives.com. And now, Leila Royale.
I think it is 2 years ago now. Rudjar and I realized that it might be important to start a legal entity, a corporate entity. Too close to that. That while Rudjar has been, I guess the most I can say, and it is a lot, being Rudjar for the last 88, nearly 89 years, that we can't expect him to stay here forever with us, and that it was a good idea to begin planning some kind of a legal corpus to basically continue or to contain and spread the momentum of whatever had been working through his life and his ideals during the span of time that he has been here. So that is how RITA, the Rudjar Institute for Transpersonal Activity, began. And we really didn't know what RITA was or would become. And essentially, we still don't. But this weekend marks an important stage. It's the next year. RITA seems to grow in years. We're not rushing things. Where we thought that bringing together whoever would turn up, whoever was sufficiently interested by, committed to studying the ideas, the approach to life that Rudjar has developed, has pioneered through all of these years, would come together in a place that would be conducive to discussion, contemplation, meditation, talking, laughing with one another, having a good time, hearing Rudjar speak, and essentially to see what would come out of the synergy of all of us. So here we are on the threshold of that adventure, and I'm as eager as all of you to find out what is happening. My sense is that this is your conference. It's all of our conference, and that we all together constitute at this moment a large potentiality that will actualize itself in some way over the next few days, and we hope also over the next however many years, in terms of some sorts of meaningful activities that will develop. So it's also, I think, significant that while planning for RITA entailed planning for a time when Rudjar would eventually not be among us, he is still very much among us. In fact, he informed me that by his calculation, today was significantly his half birthday. And that, in fact, that this was his 177th half birthday. Rudjar, for those of you who know us personally, you know that Rudjar has the longest running birthdays in the world. His birthday is always 4 days at least to count for the sidereal solar return and the tropical solar return, the solar return in Paris, the solar return in Palo Alto. So he's now figured out a way to stretch it a little further. But it's also for all of our benefit because it's nice to have birthday. So on that rather frivolous note, I'll apologize for Rudjar doing this to him, but on that rather frivolous note, I'll ask Rudjar to please start us out to give us a push in the right direction.
Well, welcome, all of you. And as I look at all your face, mostly unknown, and which I cannot see very clearly anyway, I wonder if what makes you come to this place vibrated with the same kind of urgency that made us organize this coming together. Urgency of what? Well, an urgency to realize clearly what is really involved in a word which has become very popular, very often used, and very little understood, perhaps, transformation. What is involved in a radical, root-organized change? What it demands of us or of our total being, if that change is to be full of being, persistent, enduring, and in a sense, irrevocable. The idea of such change, of course, is as ancient of not the world, but at least the last few millennia of our humanity. It has been represented, symbolized by the metamorphosis of the worm into the butterfly through the chrysalis state. But what we have to realize is that apparently the worm does not desire to be a butterfly, and certainly doesn't desire to pass through that rather awkward state of chrysalis. And similarly, the whole of humanity, the whole of the human species, is propelled by an unconscious evolutionary need to become more than it is. But that need, which is unconscious, which is a slow process of evolution in terms of humanity as a whole, can be realized by individuals as an imperative need for change. And if they realize it, they can act because of this realization. Now, this sounds very well, but the next thing is, what is implied in such a change? Oh yes, I want to change, fine. Then what does that mean? What does that demand of me? Why, how? Well, three factors are involved, basically. Many more, of course, small factors, but basically, first you have to have a matter of feeling. You have to have a profound dissatisfaction with what you are, what you operate in, your society, your group, your family, or whatever it is. It is an emotional sense of rebellion, that you don't belong there, that you don't want to do the things that other people do, that a change has to happen. But it is a matter of feeling, emotional feeling, rebellion, a negative, what you are not. Then, of course, comes a mental realization. You should realize why the thing that you are in is unbearable to you, how it has become unbearable, why it has become as bad as you think it is, and somehow you have to have a sense that either there are alternatives and that you connected with one, that you have faced with one of them, the possibility of one of them, and what it implies, and so on. Then you have a third factor, without which nothing happens. And that is the will. Now, in modern days of, since the consciousness movement, modern psychology, human potential and whatnot, very little is said about the will. Everything is supposed to be a matter of consciousness. But consciousness means nothing without the will to implement what you are conscious of. And it doesn't mean anything, really, if you are not willing to sever, to break away from what you have been belonging to up to that particular moment. Now, human being can use that will because they can imagine a new state of being, a new state of consciousness, a new kind of society, a new kind of relationship. The worm apparently doesn't know how to become a butterfly because he has not imagined the state of the butterfly. But human beings have that possibility of imagining a new state, not only in terms of their own personality, but in terms of a much larger state of human evolution. We can have a realization of a vast tide of change, which involves the whole planet, the whole of humanity. And we can consciously move with that tide, or we can resist it, we can ignore it altogether, because we fear the change. Now, it is obvious that no one can feel or will for you. Nevertheless, there is such thing as a contagion of example. Rebellion may be also powered by a certain kind of contagion among the people around you. But what is even more important, there must be some sort, sometimes, of example, something which gives a form, a desirable form, to an alternative. And later we will see, mostly Sunday again, that therefore in basic process of change, there is a relationship established between an exemplar, an ideal example, and whoever is in the process of change. But nevertheless, the change will succeed as the intensity of the desire of change is great. Now, just merely having an intellectual interest in something different, in a new theory, or merely imitating your peer group because it's fashionable to do that, which is very often the case, that is not sufficient. Now, what this Rudia Institute is meant to and capable, perhaps, to do if you allow it to grow and become more powerful is to, as clearly as possible, formulate an alternative world view. After pointing out the fallacies, the perversions which mark the past and the thing which you are still born out of or in the process of being born out of, we have first to understand to some extent what went wrong in the past of our culture, of our Western world, let us say. Why it went wrong? Every new departure has always to pierce through an accumulation of mental, emotional ghosts. And you carry those ghosts within you, whether you are aware of it or not. You carry them in your subconscious, and they are there inside of your psyche, and you have to deal with them. And you have to deal with them on the basis of the realization that something which is light, which is alive, which you can contribute to, which it is your destiny to contribute to, is there, and you can deal with them. But you have to have a realization that a process of severance, I use that term, it's an old religious term, but it's a very good term, because it means to sever from, to break away from, to cut out from. In the gospel, Jesus says, I came to bring you a sword, not peace. It is the sword of severance. You cannot emerge into the future until you have cut away your attachment to the past. And you may be free intellectually, free to some extent emotionally, even as far as your conscious emotions are. But very often, it is extremely difficult to be free from the unconscious or subconscious attachment. And even when you think that you have done it very thoroughly, you find your dreams revealing to yourself for years that still the ghosts are still there. Now, it may be that if I bring some of the process to your consciousness, by which the process by which I managed to come to this condition today after many, many years, it might possibly be of value to you, make it more personal. And in a sense, everybody loves to be personal these days in America. It may be of value because, in a sense, some of the approach I took was not the kind which is usually taken today or which is considered almost impossible to avoid. Now, when I was 16 years old, 1911, my father died. I had been very ill, practically dying for 3 or 4 years before. And the question was, of course, what was ahead for me? Now, I realized something more or less clearly, of course, that it was only if I could discover and understand what kind of society or a culture I was living in and which had formed my mind, my brain capacity. If I could realize that, this would be absolutely necessary in order to realize what my work was. I had felt, I was feeling around that time, definitely separate from my culture, from my family, large family, and Catholic family, if you want, very middle class, fairly semi-wealthy middle class, very middle class, not at all interested in spirituality, art, culture, or anything of that kind. Well, I realized that I had to discover who I was only if I could find what my function, what my work of destiny was, wherever I would be. What was my relationship to the work I was to live in? If that relationship changed, I realized, that would also change who I am. I had never had a feeling that who I am, is a very important thing, or that it could be found unrelated to anything. It could only be found in a state of relation with the culture or the society or the family or whatever it was that I was in and yet did not feel I belonged to. Well, this led me during the winter fall, 11, 12, 16, 17 year old, to realize that our Western culture, at that time in men's Europe, because I had no idea what America was, land of barbarian, far away, never heard anything, that my European culture was definitely disintegrating. Now, it was the great season, the grand season, the glorious days of Europe, supposedly. But I realized then, nevertheless, that it was the beginning of a fall season, that a culture was a living entity, a living organism, and that it had reached its fall season, its autumn. Now, mind you, Spengler was just working on his famous book, The Down Thing of the West, Toyn Beer, not written, was anything, anything like that. But for some mysterious reason, I had that intuition very strongly. And I realized that, okay, fine, our culture is in the fall period. Now, what happened in the fall of the year? And immediately, of course, I was struck with the idea that in the fall, if you look at the vegetation cycle as a symbol, you know, not. There are two things that happen. The leaves decay. They can be beautiful, golden, but they decay. And there are seeds which are very inconspicuous, which when the fruit also rot away, fall down on the ground. Both the leaves and the seed fall. But the seed decay into humus, undifferentiated chemicals. But within the seed, there is the possibility of rebirth, the immortality of the structure which represents the species to which the seed belongs. And so, I realize that, to some extent, a choice was there. You could either follow the realm of the leaves, becomes golden, maybe beautiful red, gold, and so on, but connect with the movement of decay, the entropy, the descent into chaos, into uniformity, into chemical unconsciousness. Or you could be like a seed which would contain within yourself the potential of future rebirth. But obviously, that potentiality of rebirth, the function of your seedhood, could only be accomplished if you cut away, if you severed yourself from the plant which had supported you, which had built you. Now, the idea of severance, of course, in that sense, is not unknown and was not unknown in the religious sense. If you join a monastic order, you sever from your family, you change your name, you adopt a completely new way of life, and that way of life is seen as a transition to a superphysical future heavenly state of being. Now, of course, for me, I did not feel that religious path as mine, because to me it belongs still to what I considered the past of my culture. And I wasn't satisfied with it. I didn't feel I belonged to it. And so, having perhaps made that decision, and realizing 2-3 years later that the First World War proved to me that I was right, that European culture was disintegrating, that suddenly an upsurge of violence, of barbarism, of cruelty, and horrible tragedy of war, and a trench war, and all that, had come, marked the end of a period. And so, I, perhaps by that realization, was allowed to have the opportunity, a difficult opportunity, which required my standing against everything that was traditional in my past, in my family, and so on, to come to America to perform or to see perform some orchestral work of mine, because I had become a composer. Now, a seed represents, in a certain sense, the harvest of a whole plant. And in a certain sense, in my mind, even though it tried to sever itself from the past, it was the past. It was the harvest of a past. It was formed by that past. And so I was able to use a certain gift and ability of my culture. I was born in Paris and so to become a composer and to have my work as an excuse, as it were, and to come to the United States. Now, that led to all sorts of things. I'm not going to go into detail, but when I came to America, the first night of the performance of my work at Metropolitan Opera by Monteux, Pierre Monteux, Wilson called the Congress to declare the war. So there again, I found the thing invaded by that same crisis that I had left in Paris. But anyway, I was there. I had established certain capacities, which gave me a certain amount of standing. I was able to have commissioned to write some music in California, and I went to California. And it is there that I found, which I had already come in touch with during the first year that I was in New York, where I read all day long while I was starving, all books on Oriental philosophy, occultism, theosophy, and all that from 9 to 10 in the evening, and suddenly find a completely new world opening to me, which I had no idea existed when I was in Paris. So the severance, you see, brings you in contact with new alternatives. The next possibility of a more concrete thing was when in California I was sent to a group which was at the center of the Theosophical Society, and a woman who organized that play, The Life of Christ, for which I was to write scenic music, was herself a very devoted theosophist. Now, I may say a few words about theosophy, because it is one of the things which is unfortunately the least understood in modern thinking, including perhaps in some ways by most theosophists themselves. What theosophy actually, what Blavatsky, who really was the real founder of the Theosophical Society, tried to do, particularly in The Secret Doctrine, was to, she used the term herself, to bring out, to reveal a granary of seed, the seed which had been produced by the many cultures, the most important culture, which had developed during the last 5 millennia, that is from about 3000 BC, which is the start of the traditional Kali Yuga in India, up to 1898, with a turning point around 600 BC, the time of Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, Pythagoras, and various other things, like the Jewish captivity in Babylon, contact with the old Chaldean world, and so on. Now, the thing that is important to realize, and people do not realize, is that theosophy was bringing the harvest of those, all those cultures, showing that they had basic similarities and a foundation, but that all cultures are limited and they all are expression or manifestation derived from a basic reality, which is, as it were, the possibility of the growth of a new kind of humanity, which is developing today and has been for centuries in an embryonic state within the ordinary humanity or mankind that we are involved in. Our present humanity is in a way the mother of that spiritual type of humanity, that embryo which is developing within the biosphere and the noosphere at the present time. And it is based on what she, Blavatsky, used to call a primal revelation. But the term revelation, of course, need not be understood exactly in a theological sense, certainly not revelation by a personal God of one kind or another. What is implied there is what you might call the blueprint, in another sense, the genetic code of that new humanity. And to make it clear, she said that that blueprint, that pattern of man, of course, in a beyond any sense of gender, anthropos, humanity, that pattern is such that it could be, that it was actually brought down and written down as a few pages of geometrical symbols. In other words, what you have there is a kind of formula of relationship. It is like a genetic code, how a number of factors are related to each other in a particular way. That particular way is what we call man, the human being. And that archetypal reality is beyond any culture. It is the source from which any culture is. Just like there is a certain genetic pattern which is called the human kingdom or mankind, but every individual or group or races has a certain aspect of that genetic code particularly developed. Now, that is the important thing, because what was implied in theosophy is that to find reality is to go beyond cultures, beyond particular culture, and to reach that which was the blueprint, the essence, the archetypal reality of man. Now, that blueprint, that structure, come down, as it were, that's a bad term, come down, but I think you know what I mean, come down into humanity gradually. It is there, race after race, evolution after evolution, it pattern come more and more clear and definite, you know. And there is what you call a hierarchy of process, just like a structural hierarchy which takes the first cell in the ovum, fecundated cell, and gradually build lung, heart, and organs of one kind. All those organic structure, level of generation of self after generation of self, create a hierarchy. This is a descending process, the structural process. Then when the thing is achieved, there is an ascending process, where from consciousness go from the purely biological, natural, animal level of mankind, because man is first an animal, and developed into more and more conscious, more and more cultured, more and more finer culture, and finally to a state where it goes beyond culture to return as a perfect being into that, into an expression, fulfilled manifestation of that archetype man, which also is not cultural, but is human in a archetypal, in a formal, structural sense. So you have a hierarchy which comes down into manifestation, which control, which guide, which structures, and you have the process of evolution, the process of refinement, of subtilization, transcendence, and all that, which lead you to a condition of unanimous perfection, which I have called in my books and in booklets the pleroma state, and which theosophy more or less refers to, I believe, as the White Lodge. A word which, of course, has been horribly misused and abused and perverted, but which represents a state which of which other religions have always spoken of, the communion of the saint, the ideal Sangha of the Buddhists and all that. They are all different names to mean the same thing. Human being reaching beyond particular culture, particular personalities and all that, reach that stage where they all together as a whole of spirit, interpenetrating whole, reach that stage of supreme so-called perfection. Now, unfortunately, that pattern and what is involved in it in relation to knowledge and to existence and to development, spiritual development, has been to a large extent lost sight of even by theosophists. Or they tend to have materialized it, personalized it, and so on, mythologized it, and so on. On top of that, a very stupid, amateurish kind of investigation by Society for Psychic Research in London investigated supposedly the headquarters of the Theosophical Society in Adyar while Blavatsky wasn't there, declared a fraud, found enemies having planted things there, which they didn't even try to investigate. And of course, then, even though it was more or less proven to be inadequate later on, once you begin to be considered a fraud and all that, it is impossible to completely eradicate the process. And in the meantime, the successor, so-called, tried to popularize what was left, what was simple, the unity of all religion, brotherhood, and all those things like that, which are all fine, wonderful, but which lack that vivid alternative, which shows that you can take a break, make a break, and enter into a process which will lead you to a transcendent state of consciousness and a supercultural state of consciousness. In the meantime, of course, the materialist of the 19th century, its great fury of individualism and greed and power hunger and colonialism and in terms of philosophy and of science, of what is called reductionism, was developing more and more. Reductionism means, of course, to reduce everything. Man is reduced to matter. Man is only reduced to conflict and struggle for life, forces, and so on. There is no structural power in the beginning. There is nothing beyond any beginning. There is no greater whole. There is no end purpose. There is no cyclic process. The cycle idea, the idea that there are cycles, that everything that we deal with is cyclic, is a whole, which is born, mature, and decay, was already condemned as a heresy in the Council of Constantinople in the 5th century AD. And the whole European society has been poisoned by that idea, that condemnation, which of course add value to make everybody and individualize things. Just like the idea that you had only one life, which either had to end in heaven or hell, the most crazy kind of crisis-producing, neurosis-producing state of affair that you can imagine, you know. But it was necessary to force people almost to a condition of hysterical wanting to be saved, you know, and therefore to be good, to transmute, or to at least to go beyond, transform to some extent the strictly biological drives and impulse that had conditioned and dominated utterly the animal level of existence. Culture is an attempt to deal with biology. It's an attempt to reduce the possibility of biological impulse to make some valid and some invalid, so that you could gradually begin to dominate those impulses and the energy of those impulses, and therefore gradually come to a realization that there was something transcendent, altogether transcendent, to biology. Now, you pass from life to that higher level there through the level of culture. One culture after another, each one has certain things to develop, certain quality of the mind to develop. It is mind which is the transition. Mind, culture, personhood. You are a person when you function in a culture. If you were not born in a culture, if you had no language, no relationship with anything, you wouldn't be a person. You would be an animal with the potentiality to be human, but you would not be a person. You are not born as a person. You are born as an animal. But as you relate to other persons, to breathing the air which has been breathed by all humanity very shortly, because atmosphere circulates very fast around the earth, you become connected with the whole of humanity. You become connected particularly with your culture, with the people around you, your family, your society. Then you become a person. A collective person, because you are dominated by those collective factors. But you can eventually individualize, become an individual, if you begin to look at that collective thing independently, objectively, and become separate from it.
This is the end of Astrology and Transpersonal Living, Part 1 by Dane Rudyar. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Leila Rudyar Hill and was brought to you by Rita, the Rudyar Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about Rita or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyar at www.rudyarinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyar, visit www.rudyaraudioarchives.com.